Scene 12. Our first day back in class was surprisingly quiet. Wren hadn't appeared, and Meredith arrived so late Monday night that none of us saw her, and she was given permission to sleep through Tuesday. With only the boys and Philippa in attendance, our teachers seemed content to simply explain what the short winter term between Thanksgiving and Christmas would include: Romeo and Juliet, our introduction to weapons combat, and midterm speeches. Evening found the four of us in the castle library, vigorously tidied by me the previous day, writing out our new monologues and beginning to scan them. Pens, pencils, highlighters, notebooks, and wine glasses were strewn on every table. A towering fire lit the whole room but didn't keep the cold entirely at bay. Philippa and I sat toe to toe on the couch, one thick wool blanket stretched over both of us. My eyelids had begun to droop an hour before, and at last I let them close. I might have fallen asleep if not for the constant motion of Philippa's left foot, which wiggled persistently against my leg as she wrote. The words of my newest piece tumbled around between my ears, disconnected and chaotic, not yet regimented and committed to memory. They'd given me something surprisingly robust: Philip the Bastard's rousing battle speech from King John. "Your royal presences be ruled by me. Be friends a while, and both conjointly bend your sharpest deeds of malice on this town. And when that we have dashed them to the ground, why then defy each other, and pell-mell make work upon ourselves for heaven or hell." I sat up when a small voice said,
"Hello? Sorry I'm late."
"Wren!" James launched himself out of his chair. She was standing in the doorway, eyes dreamy and tired, a carry-on bag slung over her shoulder. "We thought you weren't coming back," Alexander said, shooting a dirty look down the hall toward Meredith's room.
"Had enough of me?" Wren asked, as James pulled her bag off her shoulder and set it on the floor. "Of course not. How are you?"
Philippa stood up with her arms already open. Wren drifted into her embrace and hugged her tight around the waist.
"Better now."
I followed Philippa off the couch and, in a moment of foolish affection, put my arms around them both.
"Us too."
Alexander snorted. "Really?" he said. "Group hug? Are we going to do this?"
"Shut up,"
Wren said, her cheek squashed against Philippa's shoulder.
"Don't spoil it."
"Fine." A second later, Alexander's long monkey arms crushed us all together, and then James latched on as well. We lost our balance, swayed, Wren trapped and laughing at the heart of our human knot. The sound shivered through us, moving fluidly from one body to the next like a breath of warm air.
"What's going on in here?"
I looked over everyone's heads toward the hall.
"Meredith."
She stood in the doorway barefoot, barefaced, in leggings and a long T-shirt I was fairly sure had once belonged to Richard. Her hair was tousled, her eyes dusky and slow. I hadn't seen her since the airport, and I felt slightly winded. Our little clutch broke apart, each of us retreating half a step, until Wren emerged again from the middle. Meredith's stern expression softened.
"Wren." "Me?"
She smiled weakly. Meredith blinked, staggered into the room, and crashed into her. The two of them were hugging and laughing and falling over all at the same time, and Philippa and I barely caught them before they hit the coffee table. When we were all upright again, smarting from colliding elbows and trodden on toes, Meredith let go of Wren and said,
"It's about time. Best of comfort, and ever welcome to us."
"Philippa."
"You must be exhausted. When did you leave London?"
"Wren."
"Yesterday morning. I'd love to hear about Thanksgiving, but I don't want to offend anyone by falling asleep."
"Alexander." "Don't be stupid. Get thee to bed and rest, for thou hast need." "James."
Where's your suitcase?
Ren. Downstairs. I couldn't face carrying it up just yet.
James. I'll get it.
Ren.
You sure?
Let him go, Meredith said, brushing Ren's hair back off her forehead.
You look like you might need someone to carry you.
Come on, Philippa said. I'll help you get settled.
They disappeared down the hall together while James vanished into the stairwell. Alexander gave me a soporific smile and said, "The gang's all here." His eyes moved lazily from me to Meredith, and the grin slid off his face. All of her gentleness seemed to have left the room with Ren, and she stood staring at me with a hard, unassailable sort of look.
"So," Alexander said, "I think I'll go have a smoke before bed."
He wound his scarf tightly around his neck and left the room, whistling "Secret Lovers" under his breath. I considered running after him and kicking him down the stairs. Meredith was in flamingo pose again, one foot perched on the inside of the opposite knee. She made even that look graceful. I didn't know what to do with my hands, so I slid them into my back pockets, which felt far too casual.
"How was New York?" I asked. "You know, hustle and bustle," she said dryly. "We had a parade."
"Right.
How was Ohio?"
"It sucked," I said. "It always does."
The fact that I could have come to New York and didn't hung so heavily in the air between us that there was no need to mention it.
"How's your family?" I asked.
"No idea," she said. "I only saw Caleb once, and everyone else is in Canada."
"Oh."
I could picture her rambling around in an empty apartment, nothing to distract her from Richard's death. Our holidays weren't so different, probably. Hours of reading and staring at the ceiling, isolated from siblings, and parents so unfamiliar that they might as well have been a different species. Of course, I'd had the windfall of James's company, and she hadn't been so lucky. An impossible apology glued my tongue to the roof of my mouth. She folded her arms and said,
"I'm going to bed unless you've got something to say."
I didn't. I desperately wanted to, but my mind was blank. For someone who loved words as much as I did, it was amazing how often they failed me. She waited, watching me, and when I said nothing, her mask of apathy cracked for a moment, and I saw the quiet disappointment underneath.
"Well," she said. "Good night, then."
"Meredith, wait."
"What?"
she asked, the question dull and tired. I shifted my weight, uncertain, unsure, cursing my own ineloquence.
"Do you, want to sleep alone?"
"I don't know," she said. "Do you want to sleep with me, or would you rather sleep with James?"
I glanced away, hoping to hide the rising warmth in my cheeks. When I looked back again, she was shaking her head, one corner of her mouth tugged upward, caught between pity and disdain. She didn't wait for an answer, just turned and walked down the hall again. I watched her go, mental gears whirring and churning out weak, inadequate replies until she was gone and it was too late to say anything at all. I lingered by the fireplace, debating whether to go after her, barge into her room, then throw her against the wall and kiss her until she was too out of breath for such harsh words, or just retreat to the tower and try to sleep. I was too much a coward for the former, too restless for the latter. Unable to commit to either course of action, I reached for my coat instead. The night was so cold that stepping outside felt like a slap in the face. I set off through the trees, shoulders hunched up to keep my ears warm, watching the ground for roots and rocks that might trip me in the dark. I reached the dock almost without realizing where I was. My feet had brought me there automatically, as though there were no other logical place to go.
By night, the lake was black and as still as a mirror, 500 stars perfectly reflected on the surface. There was no moon, just a small round gap in the field of stars where the moon should have been. Alexander sat on the dock by himself, legs dangling over the water. I walked to the end and stopped behind him. He must have heard me approach, but he didn't react, just sat staring out at the lake with his hands folded between his knees.
"Can I join you?" I asked, and my words emerged in a cloud.
"Of course." I sat beside him, and for a moment neither of us spoke.
"Smoke?" he said eventually.
"Yeah, I could use one." He reached inside his coat without looking, then passed a spliff to me and fumbled in his pockets for a lighter. He flicked a flame to life, and I inhaled as deeply as I could, the smoke scorching hot in my throat.
"Thanks,"
I said after my second pull and passed it back to him. He nodded, eyes pointed forward.
"How'd it go?"
I assumed he meant my conversation with Meredith.
"Not well."
We sat in silence for a while, the smoke and our breath swirling and mingling as they drifted out over the water. I tried to push Meredith out of my head, but there was no safe distraction. In every corner of my mind, doubts and fears crouched on all fours, prepared to spring and sink their teeth in me at the slightest provocation.
"Colborne was in the castle," I said, without really planning to.
I hadn't told any of them what I'd overheard, but it was dangerous knowledge to have, and I didn't trust myself with it.
"When?" he demanded.
"Yesterday."
"Did you talk to him?"
"No, but I heard him talking to another cop. Young ginger guy, hadn't seen him before."
Alexander swallowed a mouthful of smoke, and it unfurled from his nostrils in a distinctly dragonish way.
"What were they talking about?" he asked, with a diffidence that suggested he didn't really want to know.
"All this?"
I made a loose, unspecific gesture that included the lake, the dock, and both of us.
"You think he suspects something?" Alexander asked.
To someone who didn't know him so well, he might not have sounded scared.
"He knows we lied. He just doesn't know about what."
"Shit."
"Yeah."
He sucked on the spliff and the end flared orange, a single bright ember in the bleak Illinois wilderness. There wasn't much left but the roach. He passed it to me. I took one last drag and stubbed it out.
"So what do we do?"
"Nothing, I guess," he said, and that empty word "nothing" made me clench my fists in my pockets.
"Stick to our story. Try to keep our wits about us."
"We should tell the others. He's just waiting for one of us to slip up."
He shook his head.
"They'll start acting funny if they know." I chewed on my bottom lip, wondering how much danger we were really in. I thought of meeting James in the bathroom the night of the party. By some unspoken agreement, we hadn't mentioned it to the others. It was trivial, unimportant. But the possibility that we weren't the only ones keeping secrets made my heart drum a little faster. If we'd all lied to one another the way we'd lied to Colborne, I couldn't finish the thought.
"What do you think happened to him?" I asked.
"After he left the castle?"
"Dunno." He knew who I meant. "I can't imagine he just stumbled around in the woods."
"Where were you, anyway?"
He gave me a shifty sort of look and said,
"Why?"
"Just curious. I missed everything that happened after I, went upstairs."
"If I tell you, you have to swear to keep your mouth shut."
"Why?"
"Because unlike you," he said loftily, "I don't kiss and make sure the whole school knows about it."
Half curious and half annoyed, I said,
"Who were you with, jackass?"
He turned away from me with a smug little smile on his mouth.
"Colin."
"Colin?"
I didn't think he liked guys.
Alexander's smile broadened just enough to show his sharp canine teeth.
Neither did he.
I laughed, grudgingly, which would have seemed impossible 2 minutes before.
Call up the right master constable. We have recovered the most dangerous piece of lechery that ever was known in the Commonwealth.
Look who's talking.
Fuck's sake, I said. She started it.
Obviously. No offense, Oliver, but starting things isn't exactly your M.O.
I shook my head, my amusement dampened by the lingering bitterness of my conversation with Meredith.
I am so stupid. Alexander, if it makes you feel any better, I'd have done exactly the same thing.
Me. What are you?
Alexander, sexually amphibious.
Me. That's the grossest thing I've ever heard.
Alexander, you should try it.
Me. I've had enough sexual misadventures for 1 year, thanks.
I sighed and looked down at my own reflection on the surface of the water. My face seemed somehow unfamiliar, and I squinted, trying to work out what was different. The realization hit me like a blow to the stomach. With my dark hair a little wilder than usual and my blue eyes hollowed out by the weak starlight, I almost resembled Richard. For one sickening moment, he stared back at me from the bottom of the lake. I looked up sharply.
You okay? Alexander asked. For a second there, it looked like you were going to throw yourself in.
Oh, no.
Good. Don't.
He climbed to his feet.
Come on. It's fucking freezing, and I'm not leaving you out here alone.
All right.
I stood, brushing little bits of ash out of my lap.
Alexander buried his hands deep in his pockets, searching the darkness that shrouded the opposite shore.
I was on my way back from Colin's room, he said, and it seemed random until he added,
when I found him.
Wandered down here for a smoke, and
there he was.
I didn't even think to check if he was alive. He seemed so totally dead.
Must not have heard me.
I didn't know why he was telling me.
Perhaps he relived that terrible moment of discovery every morning, the same way I felt my stomach drop and found myself neck deep in memory almost every time I closed my eyes.
Know what's weird, though? He said.
What?
There was blood in the water, but not on the dock.
I glanced down at my feet. The wood was clean and dry, bleached like bone by years of wind and sun and water. Not a speck of red. Not a stained spot.
So?
So his face was smashed in. If he hit his head and fell in the water, what the hell did he hit?
The stub of our spliff smoldered on the very edge of the dock.
Alexander nudged it off with the toe of his shoe. Ripples moved outward from the point of impact, warping the reflection of the sky, so the stars wobbled and winked in and out of existence.
I keep thinking of the bird.
I didn't even want to say it. It was a tick, a compulsion, as though I might get the image out of my head if I got the words out of my mouth.
He looked sideways at me, completely nonplussed.
What bird?
From Hamlet. That's what he reminded me of.
Oh, he said. Not sure I can see him as a sparrow. Too delicate.
So what sort of bird would he be?
Dunno. The sort that smacked into a window trying to have a go at its own reflection.
It was my turn to look at him strangely, but as soon as our eyes met, I wanted to laugh. I was horrified until I realized he was fighting it too.
Oh my God, I said, shaking my head.
Alexander let the breath he was holding burst out, chuckled softly.
When did we become such terrible people?
Maybe we've always been terrible.
He shrugged and watched the white cloud of his laughter shimmer and fade.
His good humor seemed to vanish with it, and when he spoke again, his voice was brittle. "Or maybe we learned from Richard," he said. That scared me more than Colborne did. Scene 13. A week later, we arrived in the refectory for breakfast and found it humming with holiday excitement. At every table, people were tearing invitations open and chattering about the Christmas mask, which was to go forward as usual in defiance of recent events. The commotion was surprisingly refreshing after weeks of bowed heads and stiff, unsmiling faces. "Who wants to gather the mail?" Alexander asked, digging into a pile of hash browns with characteristic relish. Philippa had bullied him out of bed for breakfast, insisting that if he skipped any more meals, he'd simply vanish into thin air. "Why bother?" I asked. "We know what it says." Philippa blew steam off her coffee and said, "You don't think it might be a little different this year?" "I don't know. Sort of seems like they're trying to get back to normal." "And thank God," Alexander said. "I'm sick of being stared at."
"It could be worse."
Wren pushed eggs around on her plate, not eating. She looked thin and wan, as if she hadn't eaten anything for days.
"People keep looking around me and through me like I don't exist."
We sat in tongue-tied silence, avoiding one another's eyes and Richard's empty chair, while the other students continued to jabber at one another about the mask, what they'd wear, and how spectacular the ballroom would be. The spell of isolation broke when Colin appeared at the edge of our table, one hand alighting, unnoticed by everyone but me, on the back of Alexander's chair. "Morning," he said, and then frowned. "Everyone all right?" "Yes." Alexander speared a sausage on the end of his fork, a little violently. "Just considering starting our own leper colony down at the castle." "They do stare, don't they?" Colin said, glancing around as if he'd just noticed the wide berth everyone was giving our table. "Voyeuristic little shits," Alexander said, and bit the sausage in half, teeth snapping down like a guillotine. "What brings you into exile with the rest of us?" Colin held up a familiar envelope, small and square, a black splash of Frederick's writing on the front. "We've been given R&J assignments," he said. "Thought you'd like to know." "Oh?" Alexander twisted around his chair, glancing across the room to the wall where all our mailboxes were. "Want me to grab them?"
"No, that's all right."
Meredith pushed her chair back and threw her napkin down in her seat.
"I need another coffee. I'll go."
She left the table, and as she crossed the room, people drifted automatically out of her way, like they were afraid her misfortune might be contagious. I felt a little snag of anger or anxiety. I couldn't tell the two apart anymore. After Richard's death, they were somehow indistinguishable. Tore a piece of bacon in half and proceeded to crumble it into oblivion. I didn't realize I was ignoring everyone else until Philippa said loudly, "Oliver?"
"What?"
"You're torturing your bacon."
"Sorry, I'm not hungry. I'll see you guys in class."
I stood and carried my plate to the kitchen. I dumped it in the bin without bothering to scrape it off and went back out again. Meredith was still picking through the mailboxes, collecting our letters. I glared at a table of language students who were watching her until they bent their heads over their breakfasts again, whispering fiercely in Greek. "Meredith," I said, when I was close enough that only she would hear me. She looked up, eyes flicking dispassionately across my face before she turned back to the mailboxes.
"Yes?"
"Look," I said without hesitating. My annoyance with the rest of the student body had somehow made me bolder than usual. "I'm sorry about the other night, and I'm sorry about Thanksgiving. I'll be the first one to admit I don't know what we're doing here, but I want to figure it out." She stopped rifling through the mailboxes, her hand perched on the edge of the one labeled Sterling, Wren. Right next to it was Richard's mailbox, empty. They hadn't removed his name. I forced myself to ignore it and look at Meredith. Her expression was inscrutable, but at least she was listening to me.
"Why don't we go get a drink or something?" I asked, leaning a little closer. "Just us. I can't think straight with everyone watching like we're a reality show."
She folded her arms, said skeptically, "Like a date?" I wasn't sure what the right answer was.
"I guess.
I don't know, we'll figure it out when we get there." Her face softened, and I was startled all over again by how pretty she was.
"All right, we'll get a drink."
She put a pair of envelopes in my hand and left me alone by the mailboxes, staring dumbly after her. It was a moment or two before I realized the language students were gawping at me in her absence. I sighed, pretended not to see them, and opened my first envelope. The script on the front was long and loopy, not at all like Frederick's compact, tilted scribble. A blue silk ribbon had been fixed to the back with a wax seal bearing the Delacour coat of arms. I slid my finger underneath it and flicked it open. The note was short and the same as it had been the last 3 years, except for the date. "You are cordially invited to the annual Christmas mask. Please arrive in the Josephine Delacour Ballroom between 8 and 9 p.m. on the evening of Saturday, 20th December. Masks and formal attire are required." The second envelope was smaller, less ornate. I tore it open, quickly scanned the writing inside. "Please be in the ballroom at 8:45 p.m. on December 20th. Come prepared for Act 1, Scenes 1, 2, 4, and 5, Act 2, Scene 4, and Act 3, Scene 1. You will be playing Benvolio. Please report to the costume shop at 12:30 p.m. on December 15th for a fitting. Please report to the rehearsal hall at 3 p.m. on December 16th for combat choreography. Do not discuss this with your peers." I left the refectory without going back to our table. Colin had taken my seat. All of their envelopes were open, and they took turns glancing at one another, wondering whose note from Frederick said what. For the first time, I decided I didn't really want to know.
Scene 14. Our winter term schedule was so chaotic that it was 5 days before Meredith and I found a free minute to sneak away from the castle. James and Wren and Philippa were locked in their various rooms, likely learning lines. We hardly had enough time to do them justice, and Alexander had disappeared early in the evening, probably, I thought, with Colin, though I kept this hypothesis to myself. What with R&J and work to do on our midterm speeches, we were all unusually high-strung. The idea of a quiet drink was wonderfully appealing, but even as I held the door to the bar for Meredith to precede me, I wasn't sure either one of us really had the time. I had expected the place to be mostly empty, considering the day, Sunday, and the amount of work we all had to do before the 20th, staggering. But the Boar's Head was surprisingly crowded, our usual table commandeered by a gaggle of philosophy students who were arguing loudly about the significance of Euclid of Megara's cross-dressing habit. "What are they all doing out?" I asked, as Meredith led me to a small table on the opposite side of the room. "Don't they have homework?"
"Yes, but they don't also have half a play to memorize," she said. "Our perspective's a little skewed."
"Must be," I said. "Let me get us a drink." She sat and pretended to look at the cocktail card as though we didn't know it by heart, while I slid between chairs and stools to get to the bar. The guy to my left, a third-year dance student, I thought, gave me a dirty look when I asked for a pint and a vodka soda with lemon. He shook his head as I paid and lifted his glass to his mouth without a word. "Thanks," I muttered at the bartender, and carried both drinks across the room, careful not to spill anything on myself as I dodged outstretched ankles and chair legs and wet spots on the floor. Meredith accepted her vodka gratefully and sucked half of it down before we said another word to each other. Our conversation was unexpectedly awkward. We made superficial, silly remarks about our speech assignments and the upcoming mask, all the while acutely aware that we weren't really alone. Ours was the third of five tables in a row, and the small groups seated on either side of us had grown suspiciously quiet when we sat down. They were almost all girls, I noticed, and all Delacour students. Had girls always whispered so much? I couldn't decide if it was a new development or something I simply hadn't noticed. Admittedly, I had never before been worth whispering about. Meredith finished her drink, and I jumped on the opportunity to get her another one. While I was waiting for it, I considered buying myself a shot. I couldn't help wondering how differently the night might have been going if we actually had some privacy, and decided that if everything proceeded in the same dreadful way, I'd suggest we finish our drinks and head back to the castle, where we could at least lock a door or escape to the garden and breathe a little more freely. When I sat back down, Meredith smiled at me with obvious relief. "It's weird not being at our normal table," I said. "I don't think I've ever even sat on this side of the room."
"We haven't been in much," she said. "I think we forfeited our claim."
I glanced over my shoulder at the philosophers, still debating Euclid's possibly homoerotic obsession with Socrates. It sounded like wishful thinking to me. "We can probably win it back," I said. "If we got everyone down here, we could storm the beach."
"We'll have to arrange that."
She smiled again, but the smile was uncertain. Her hand rested on the table, and in a moment of rare bravery, I reached out and set my own on top of it. Four of her fingers curled around two of mine.
"You all right?"
I asked in a stage whisper.
"I mean, really all right?"
She stirred her drink around.
"I'm trying. In spite of what everyone thinks, I'm sick of the staring, too."
I couldn't keep my eyes from darting toward the other tables.
"It sounds callous, but I don't care. I don't want to just be the dead guy's girlfriend anymore."
I wanted immediately to let go of her hand. "And you want to be what?" I said without thinking. "My girlfriend?" She glared at me, surprise wiping every other emotion off her face.
"What?"
"I'm not Richard's understudy," I said. "I'm not going to step in and play his part now that he's left the stage. That's not what I want."
"I don't want that either. That's exactly what I don't want. Jesus, Oliver."
Her eyes were hard, green bottle glass, sharp-edged and brittle.
"Richard and I were done," she said. "He was a bastard and a bully to me and everyone else, and I was done with him. I know nobody wants to remember that now that he's gone, but you should."
I lowered my voice.
"I'm sorry," I said. Maybe it's because you're you, and I mean, look at you. But I don't understand. Why me? I'm nobody."
She looked away, biting hard on her bottom lip, like she was trying not to cry, or maybe not to scream. Her hand was limp and cool under mine, as if it were no longer connected to the rest of her. The tables on either side of us had stopped talking altogether.
"You know, everyone calls you nice," she said slowly, expression drawn and thoughtful. "But that's not the word. You're good. So good you have no idea how good you are."
She laughed, once. A sad, resigned sort of sound.
"And you're real. You're the only one of us who isn't acting all the time, who isn't just playing whatever part Gwendolyn gave you 3 years ago."
Her eyes found mine again, the echo of that laugh lingering around her mouth.
"I'm as bad as the rest of them. Treat a girl like a whore and she'll learn to act like one."
Her shoulders inched up, barely a shrug.
"But that's not how you treat me. And that's all I wanted."
I squeezed my eyes shut, then looked up at the ceiling. It was the only safe place to look, the only place I knew I wouldn't find five other sets of eyes staring back at me. "I'm sorry," I said again, wishing I had never spoken, wishing I'd had the sense to sit there with her and marvel at the fact that she wanted to sit there with me and not ask why. It should have been so easy. But nothing between us ever would be. If this was what we wanted, we'd played foully for it. We could leave the bar and escape the scrutiny of other students, but locked doors didn't matter when it was Richard watching us. Meredith seemed weary more than angry.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry too.
So where does that leave us? I asked, afraid to put too much hope into the question. Courage, man, Romeo told me again, the lying bastard. The hurt cannot be much.
I don't know. Nowhere.
She pulled her hand away.
Let's just go back to the castle. Better there than here.
I stood and gathered our empty glasses in bashful silence. I helped her into her coat, let one hand linger on her shoulder. She didn't seem to feel it, but at the table next to ours, I heard one girl mutter to the others,
"Fucking shameless."
But shame burned hot on my face and neck as I followed Meredith out into the deep December darkness. The first flurries of snow danced against a black sky, and I found myself hoping they would tumble down in millions, stick fast, and bury everything. Scene 15. The schedule for our midterm speeches was posted on the call board in the crossover on Monday. I was slated to go first during what ordinarily would have been rehearsal time on Wednesday afternoon, and Ren would follow me. James and Philippa were scheduled to read at the same times on Thursday, Alexander and Meredith at the same times on Friday. Snow had fallen thick and fast from Sunday night through Tuesday morning, doing its best to fulfill the reckless wish I'd made on the way out of the bar. Our feet and fingers were perpetually numb, our cheeks and noses rosy pink, chapstick suddenly a valuable commodity. On Wednesday, Frederick and Gwendolyn ushered us into the drafty rehearsal hall, where we shed scarves, coats, and gloves, and were subjected to a rigorous warm-up exercise of Gwendolyn's selection. I rushed headlong into my speech while Wren waited in the hallway. I'd play incessantly upon these jades, even till unfenced desolation leave them as naked as the vulgar air, forced me to slow down, and the strength of the imagery carried me more steadily through. How like you this wild council, mighty states, when I felt obliged to gather speed again. At the end I was winded, but weirdly elated, relieved to be someone other than myself for a while, more willing to go to war than face my own ugly, meager demons. Frederick and Gwendolyn were both smiling at me, Gwendolyn's mouth a bold slash of her dark winter lipstick, Frederick's a small, creased bow.
"Very good, Oliver," Gwendolyn said. "A little hurried at the top, but you fell into it very nicely."
"I found it entirely persuasive," Frederick told me, which argues great success on your part." "Thank you," I said.
"You'll get the rest of our comments in your mailbox tomorrow," Gwendolyn said. "But I wouldn't worry. Have a seat."
I thanked them again and went to sit beside their table, gulping down water from the bottle under my chair while we waited for Wren. Gwendolyn summoned her from the crossover, and when she appeared, I was alarmed by how small and frail she looked.
"Good morning," she said,
her voice only an echo in the cavernous room.
"Good morning," Frederick said. "How are you?"
"All right," she said, but I didn't believe it.
Her face and hands were pale, dark circles showing beneath both her eyes.
"A little under the weather."
"With this sort of weather, everyone's under it," Gwendolyn said and gave her a wink.
Wren tried to laugh, but lurched into a deep cough instead. I glanced uneasily at Frederick, but I couldn't see past the glare on his glasses.
"What do you have for us today?" he asked. "Lady Anne, isn't it?"
"That's right." "Lovely," Gwendolyn said. "When you're ready."
Wren nodded, then squared her feet on the floor 10 paces back from the table. I frowned across the room at her, unsure if it was my imagination or if she was trembling. Wren.
I would to God that the inclusive verge of golden metal that must round my brow were red-hot steel to sear me to the brain. Anointed let me be with deadly venom and die ere men can say, God save the Queen.
Her words rang high and clear under the vaulted ceiling, but they wavered too. She continued bravely, her small body contracting even smaller under the crushing weight of Anne's pain. I didn't doubt that she felt it as intensely as if it were her own. Wren.
This was my wish. Be thou, quoth I, accursed, for making me so young, so old, a widow. And when thou wedst, let sorrow haunt thy bed. And be thy wife, if any be so mad, as miserable by the life of thee, as thou hast made me by my dear lord's death.
Her voice cracked, the sound too harsh to be an actor's affectation. She struck her chest hard with one fist, but whether it was a wordless expression of her grief or a desperate attempt to dislodge whatever was choking her, I couldn't tell. Gwendolyn leaned forward on the table, brow creased with concern. But before she could speak, Wren's voice came stammering out again, broken and disjointed. She was bent almost in half, one hand still on her chest, the other digging violently into her stomach. I froze in my seat, gripping the sides of my chair so hard my fingertips went numb. Wren.
Lo, ere I can repeat this curse again, even in so short a space, my woman's heart grossly grew captive to his honey words, and proved the subject of my own soul's curse, which ever since hath kept my eyes from sleep, for never yet 1 hour in his bed.
She stopped, faded out, and swayed on the spot. She blinked ponderously and murmured,
Sleep.
I knew she was going to fall, but I was too slow leaping out of my chair to catch her before she crumpled to the floor. Scene 16. I returned to the castle an hour later, the cold gnawing at my limbs even as I climbed the stairs. I was still shivering, or maybe shaking, like Wren, a symptom unrelated to the temperature outside, when I appeared in the library doorway. James and Philippa were on the couch, noses buried in their scripts until they heard me come in. Stale shock must have lingered in my expression because they both jumped to their feet. Philippa.
Oliver.
James.
What's wrong?
I tried to speak, but at first no sound came out, lost in the clamor of immediate memories crowding my brain. James grabbed both my shoulders.
Oliver, look at me, he said. What is it?
It's Wren, I said. She just collapsed in the middle of her speech.
What?
He spoke so loudly that I flinched away from him.
What do you mean, collapsed? Is she all right? Where?
James, let him talk. Philippa pulled him back a step and said more gently but still white-faced, What happened? I told them, in a monologue fraught with awkward stops and pauses, how Wren had keeled over in the rehearsal hall, how, after an abortive attempt to revive her, I'd gathered her up off the floor and run full tilt to the infirmary with Gwendolyn and Frederick close on my heels, struggling to keep up.
She's stable now, that's what they said. She was just opening her eyes when the nurses shoved me out. They wouldn't let me stay.
The last piece I said apologetically to James. He opened his mouth, moved it wordlessly like a man speaking underwater, then said suddenly,
I have to go.
No, wait. I reached for his arm, but only brushed his sleeve. He was already out of reach, moving toward the door. He gave me one pained look, trying to communicate something I didn't have time to grasp, before he turned and dashed down the stairs. When he was gone, the adrenaline drained out of my body all at once, and my knees buckled. Philippa guided me into a chair, but not the nearest one. Not Richard's.
Just sit here a while and be quiet, she said. You've done enough.
I grabbed her wrist, squeezed it much too hard in a strange fit of despair. Wren had lost her grip and slipped so quickly I couldn't catch her, and now James had vanished too, out the door and into the night, like water trickling through my fingers. I was reluctant to be left alone, more reluctant still to let another friend out of my sight, as though one or the other of us might simply disappear. Philippa sank to the floor beside my chair and rested her head on my knee, saying nothing, simply waiting until I didn't need her there anymore. After 10 minutes or so, I let her go, but it wasn't until Alexander and Meredith arrived that I felt like standing up again. I told the story to them more coherently, and we spent an hour clustered close around the fire, not speaking much, waiting for news. Me. Do you think they'll go ahead with the mask? Philippa. They can't cancel it now. People would panic. Alexander. Someone else will have to learn her part. No one will even know it was supposed to be her. Meredith. I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm sick of all this mystery. We retreated into silence, watched the fire, and waited. It was midnight before James came back. Alexander had slumped sideways on the couch and fallen asleep, his face ashen, his breathing shallow, but the girls and I were awake, bleary-eyed and restless. When we heard the front door open, we all sat up straighter, listening for footsteps on the stairs. "James?" I called. He didn't reply, but a moment later he appeared in the doorway, snow clinging to his hair. 2 vivid red spots glowed on his cheeks, as if he'd had his face rouged by a little girl who had no idea what was too much. "How is she?" I asked, pushing myself off the couch to help him out of his coat. "They wouldn't let me see her." His teeth chattered, making his words quiver and stall.
"What?"
Meredith said.
"Why not?"
"I don't know. Other people were in and out and back and forth like it was Grand Central Station, but they made me sit in the hall."
"Who was there?"
Philippa asked.
"Hollinshed and all the nurses. They brought a doctor in from Broadwater. The cops were there too. That guy Colborne and another one, Walton."
Alexander had woken at James's entrance, and I looked straight at him. His mouth made a grim, hard line. "What were they doing there?" he asked, eyes on me. James fell heavily into a chair.
"I don't know. They wouldn't tell me. Just asked if I knew what she'd been up to lately."
"Well, it's exhaustion, isn't it?"
Meredith said.
"Fatigue? She's had this terrible experience, and she comes back here to have everyone skirting around her, and on top of that, 500 lines to learn. It's a miracle the rest of us are on our feet."
I was only half listening. Walton's words bounced around my brain like a stray pinball. "My money's on the cousin." I sat quietly at the table, folded James's coat, and clutched it in my lap, hoping nobody would pay any attention to me. Keeping Colborne's ongoing investigation secret from the rest of them no longer felt fair, and I doubted I'd be able to maintain my silence if anyone asked me even an unrelated question. Alexander watched me like a hawk, and when I risked lifting my eyes to meet his, he shook his head, just barely.
"What do we do?"
Philippa asked, looking from James to Meredith. "Nothing," Alexander said before either of them could speak, and I wanted to ask, "Is that your answer to everything?" I wondered how many ways he could use that word, and if my soul would squirm and shrink away every time he said it. "We carry on as usual, or they're going to want to ask all kinds of questions we don't want to answer."
"Who?"
Meredith said.
"The police?"
"No," he said swiftly. "The school. They'll pull all of us in for fucking counseling if we get any more jumped up than we are."
"We have every reason to be jumped up," she said. "One of our classmates is dead, and another one's just had some kind of nervous breakdown."
"And how do you think that looks?" he asked. "I get that we can't pretend not to be affected by it, but if we all start acting like we killed somebody, they're going to start wondering whether we did."
We did not kill him, Meredith said, instantly, angrily.
I recognized the reflex, guilt kicking out against an allegation too close to the truth.
No, of course not, Alexander said, and made every word sting. We just let him die.
At the time, it had seemed such an important distinction. But in the weeks that followed, as we recovered from the temporary madness of that morning, it grew more and more tenuous. Alexander's words snapped the last thread of pretense. We knew by then, as well as Richard did, that there was no difference at all. Alexander stood, including everyone, in a sweeping glare as he patted his pockets. I need a smoke. Come find me if there's news. He left the room abruptly, a cigarette already sticking out of his mouth. James watched him go, then slumped and let his head sink into his hands. Philippa perched on the arm of his chair, one hand alighting on the back of his neck, bending low to say something I couldn't hear. As soon as Alexander was out of sight, Meredith shot me a look of mingled indignation and confusion.
"The fuck is wrong with him?" she said.
"I have no idea,"